Hello, you're listening to America Unchained. I'm your host, Chris Tidwell, joined by my co-host, Richard Dean Winfield. In our last episode, we talked about the need for a re-examination of the necessity of our social rights and how they will ensure freedom for those hurt most by the COVID pandemic. Today, we will be picking up where we left off and hopefully going into a little bit further detail. Today, in particular, we're talking about a federal jobs guarantee, something that we see as a cornerstone for this campaign. And Richard, you ran on the federal work guarantee in the past, and then also again this time around. Oftentimes, the federal work guarantee gets posed next to a plan, something like Yang's or the universal basic income idea. And I know that you have a perspective on both of them, and they have different benefits. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about why you think the federal work guarantee is more important, but also sort of the contrast between the UBI and federal work.
Yeah. You know, when we're discussing the federal job guarantee and looking at it in contrast with the proposal of universal basic income, it's first important to recognize that both of these proposals recognize that income is something that requires public intervention in order to ensure that everyone has the income they need in order to not just provide for their, let's say, biological needs of sustenance, but to provide the conventional standard of living, which enables them to exercise their various freedoms and all of their rights. Now, this involves a recognition that the market left to its own designs, the market left to the operations of the invisible hand of competition, is not sufficient to guarantee that everyone will have an income sufficient not only to survive, but to flourish. Also, one has to keep in mind that the turn to guarantees of income through either a federal job guarantee or universal basic income presuppose that it is not wealth but income that is the ultimate foundation of economic security. And really, before we begin discussing the alternate approaches of a federal job guarantee and a universal basic income, I think it's important to examine the role that wealth has as a basis of the economic independence on which our family welfare, our social freedom, and ultimately our political participation depends. Mm. You know, because there is this kind of counter argument that it is wealth that is the real foundation of economic freedom and security. And this is tied to various notions that involve a misunderstanding, and one might even say a complete ignorance of the workings of competition. You know, there are two alternate fantasies that have been embraced by much of the public and many people on all sides of the political spectrum. And those are the ideas that everyone can be an entrepreneur, and it's the entrepreneurial spirit and it's access to capital that is really the basis of equal economic opportunity. And then there's the corollary of that notion, which is that small business is really the foundation of a community's prosperity. Now, what is being ignored is how competition requires enterprises to grow and consolidate in order to survive the pressures of competition. You know, firms need to accumulate wealth through profit that they then invest in order to become competitive by using the most competitive production and marketing facilities to develop new products and also to take advantage of economies of scale. So as a result, in every market economy, there develops a significant concentration of enterprises, or another way of putting it, there's a predominance of big business And there becomes a great disparity in the number of enterprises versus the number of employees. Because as enterprises grow, they need more and more employees. That means that, in effect, we can't all become enterprises, entrepreneurs, I should say, because competition is going to drive most of us out of business. And the same thing applies to the idea that it is small business that is really the biggest job providers, the source of economic growth, et cetera. That really can't be the case. Now, you find a similar idea of thinking about wealth as being the key factor of economic independence and all of the kind of proposals that have attempted to use wealth distribution as a basis of equal opportunity. You had proposals from the very beginnings of our colonial period, from Thomas Paine, for example, to afford every landholder at the age of 21 a certain amount of wealth. You've had proposals in more recent times by law professor Ackerman and some associates for giving everyone a certain amount of capital when they reach maturity. You have the idea of baby bonds being advanced by certain thinkers like William Darity and Derek Hamilton, which would, in a sense, ensure that everyone will have a certain amount of capital when they begin. And of course, this reflects the fact that in our own society, where you need wealth in order to ensure that you have decent housing, you need wealth in order to ensure that you have decent health care, you need wealth to ensure that you have access to education at all levels. How much wealth you have and how much wealth you can inherit has played a key role in determining your opportunity so that we can speak of intergenerational disadvantage that first and foremost applies to all those communities that have been subject to historical infringements of rights that limit their ability to accumulate wealth. But of course, it also applies to different strata among all sectors of the population, where those in the lowest income are going to have less to hand down and have less wealth. And in the United States currently, we have less social mobility than any other developed nation. You also have this emphasis on wealth in the policies of land reform that have played a big role in much of late 19th, 20th century, even the 21st century. In some respect, you saw an aspect of this after the Civil War, when freed slaves were demanding 40 acres and a mule. In effect, this is a kind of land reform where a distribution of wealth in the form of land and livestock was regarded as a basis of economic independence. Now, of course, this was under conditions of a plantation society where free labor opportunities were very, very restricted, and the government was not going to be stepping in to put people to work. You have similar kinds of proposals that took place in revolutionary Russia when Lenin and the Bolsheviks first were proposing land reform. A huge land reform program was implemented in India after independence. You had it to begin with in China after the victory of the communists. You had it, of course, in many countries that achieved independence after the ending of colonization. But one thing that happens is that land reform tries to solve the problems of economic opportunity by turning everyone into a kind of independent entrepreneur, a farming business. Now, agriculture, of course, is particularly, let's say, insecure because you have to deal with nature. You have to deal with whether you'll have enough rainfall or not. But you also have to deal with competition, and you have to take into account the fact that agriculture has proven to be susceptible to widespread mechanization. That means it's very easy for large enterprises, agricultural businesses, agribusinesses to dominate the field, so that in America today, less than 1.7% of breadwinners have their livelihood from agriculture. In other words, the little holdings that people were given were not enough to really provide economic security. And even though generally for economies in the world today, the national wealth is seven times greater, no, I'm sorry, about 5 times greater than the national income. The idea that pressing a reset button and fairly distributing wealth is going to be a measure that will ensure economic opportunity, I think is an illusion, which doesn't take into account the workings of the market that are going to undermine the opportunities of individuals. And obviously, in this country, it's quite obvious that even if we were to press a reset button and provide equal distribution of wealth, it wouldn't take very long for that distribution to fall prey to all sorts of insecurities. The moment anyone falls sick, it can all be dissipated. The moment one has to go to college, a huge chunk of it is gone. The moment you have to buy any kind of apartment or home, much if not all of it is gone. And then, of course, the question is, what are interest rates? What kind of income could you get from that wealth that you have? So I think in the now, admittedly, there are people who can and do earn a living as entrepreneurs. They are a small minority of the population, but as we mentioned in our last episode, everyone knows that if you do fail to make a living as an entrepreneur, you are left with something that all of us have once slavery is abolished, namely ownership of one's own labor power, which means you have an opportunity to support yourself if you can find a job, if you can find a job. Now, the full-time job is under increasing assault, not just because of a pandemic and because of the huge economic crisis the mismanagement of the pandemic has led to, but due to tendencies that have been accelerating in all market societies. One is the fact that there is growing automation. And that means that in certain fields, many, many people are losing their employment because they're being replaced by machines. And that has taken place to a great extent, as I mentioned, in agriculture. It's taken place in manufacturing. It's taken place in extractive industries, mining, for example. Back in the heyday of coal mining in this country in the 1920s, I think there were about 780,000 coal miners. Today, coal production is greater than it was then, but there are less than 60,000 workers in the coal industry because you now have these gigantic machines that are taking care of most of coal production in the United States. So that's one big issue. The other is globalization and the embrace of free trade policies by many nations, which has allowed corporations to, as we all know, move their production operations to other nations where they can find lower wages and take advantage of that. Now, of course, that doesn't reduce worldwide employment in the way in which automation may. But there's something else that's taking place worldwide, and that's the rise of the gig economy. And what the rise of the gig economy achieves with the ubiquity of smartphones and internet access is that enterprises can farm work out to any place, anytime, and have it be done on a piecework basis where the company doesn't have to deal with all the overhead costs of having offices, of having manufacturing or marketing operations. And of course, it allows them to avoid having to face the solidarity of employees who, if they are actually at a full-time job at a workplace, can join together and fight for their rights. Now, all of these tendencies are moving to make full-time employment much, much less of a sure bet for large parts of the population here and abroad. And it's also played a role in disempowering employees who have a much harder time making, in a sense, a common front to advance their interests and be fairly treated by employers. Now, in face of all these problems, you have advocates of universal basic income, saying that given how full-time employment is really at risk, that we have to provide everyone with a basic income so they can meet their basic needs. And this is intended as something that will not only wipe out poverty, but also be something that will liberate people from the need of having to work. And this is attached to the idea that work is bondage, that work is not in any way an exercise of rights, of freedom, but is a matter of succumbing to the necessity. The necessity of, in a way, you could say, this natural metabolism that we are all fated to engage in, where we have to deal with nature in order to meet our daily needs, etc. Now, and by the way, I think it's worthwhile to discuss the universal basic income first and look at its pros and cons as a way of introducing ourselves to the idea of a federal job guarantee. Now, the idea of universal basic income, by the way, is something that has been supported by people on all sides of the political spectrum. Conservatives have supported it. And they support it in the following manner. They say that, look, if we simply give everyone a basic income, a monthly check that will be sufficient to meet their daily recurring needs, this is something that frees individual from the paternalistic care of welfare agencies. It frees individuals from the indignity of having been subject to means tests, which serve as a gateway to obtaining, you know, any kind of welfare assistance. It also gives people complete freedom over what they're going to do with the money they're given.
Right.
Instead of having things like food stamps, which, you know, basically give you something where you have to spend it on food as opposed to anything else. It means, in other words, you're freed from being a minion of a welfare bureaucracy. You're free to basically do whatever you please. And this is going to be something that will be in accord with the personal liberty that conservatives, especially the libertarian bent, put forward. And this is regarded as something that will not only eliminate poverty and welfare dependency, but it will also be something emancipatory. Now, people on the left have made similar claims about it. Robert Reich has been in favor of a UBI. Of course, Yang put it forward in the last presidential race. Stern, the former head of, in a sense, the largest union in America, put it forward. And Martin Luther King had supported it at a certain point. Now, I think we want to look at...
If I can just jump in there for
Sorry. I've been going on too long.
No, that's okay. Also, I mean, you mentioned the people who have done it before. Apparently, Bertrand Russell, the philosopher, also proposed this as a kind of ideal. In what ways do you see this being, I suppose, something outside of a left-right distinction, and it actually being beneficial? Something like the most recent update of something like this would be the interaction between government stimulus and joblessness and COVID, but also with in juxtaposition towards the Romney plan, I think he calls it the Patriot Pay, for people to go back to work or something like this. Once again, it seems like this debate, it doesn't really have a direct left-right skew. It constantly pops up, both UBI and federal work guarantee, on both sides.
I mean, I think that the pandemic has created conditions where working safely is a challenge.
Right.
And putting people back to work is difficult. In many fields that involve personal contact. both on the side of workers and on the side of the interaction between employees and customers. And, you know, if we do not have, if we have not clamped down on a pandemic by having early on provided social distancing, personal protective equipment, testing, contact tracing, quarantining for those who are in, who are found to be either exposed or actually infected, then we're in a situation where it's hard to just let people go back to work without not only spreading the pandemic, but having people succumb and then having it difficult for businesses to operate because customers are not going to come in if they consider it unsafe. So under those conditions, it could appear we have another argument in favor of universal basic income. You know, where if we give everyone income to meet their needs, then, for example, people who will do not have to go to work or are not under the pressure to go to work and end up infecting others.
Right.
Then people can safely can afford to quarantine because they have income to get them through that. Then people are not going to be evicted and foreclosed upon if the basic income is sufficient to cover those kind of expenses. So it might appear that the situation of a pandemic is something that compounds with the situation of advancing automation and advancing gig economy, globalization and so forth, to provide more and more reasons for universal basic income.
Certainly. I mean, it seems like we have sort of a small scale Spean-Hamland experiment going on here where we have a period of time where it seems that it's just necessary that people are able to afford bread still, despite the loss of jobs. But at the same time, I mean, we still talk about sort of these freedoms of UBI, which would be under less of a crisis circumstances, ones that provide hopefully as much as you can to spend on what you'd like and spend on flowers for your garden, for example, or something like that. But in what ways does that fall short? Because for me, I feel that, well, in fact, even if I did have a certain amount of money per month, there's going to be a lot of structural payments that I'm going to have to make quite often. And it still doesn't seem like I actually have I don't really take pride in just getting a check every month for free either. So could you maybe describe some of the tensions there with freedom and...
I mean, remember there are these two sides of the UBI proposal, universal basic income. One is that it is something that is going to eliminate poverty and the disadvantage that represents. And on the other hand, it's something that is emancipatory. Hmm. It liberates us from having to, in a sense, succumb to the necessities of having to provide for our needs. Now, the universal basic income is basic for an important reason.
Right.
There's an understanding that it cannot be so high that it will completely remove the incentive to work. Because ultimately, there's not going to be any income to distribute unless there are individuals who do engage in economic activity and the production of wealth. And the one thing about the universal basic income proposal is that everyone receives it, irrespective of whether they're working or not. And it's basic because it can't eliminate, in some respect, you might say, the need of individuals to seek employment. Hmm. So that it really does not, let's say, provide us with equal opportunity. It really provides us with a starkly segmented society in which you have those who have just a basic income and those who have the basic income plus the income they receive by going to work and engaging in the production of wealth that everyone is receiving. So you have, in a sense, this, you could call it two classes of individuals. One, who are li those who are living on universal basic income. And if you think about the proposals that are put forward by Yang and others, the income in question is very basic. He proposed 1,000 per month. That's a kind of typical amount that people propose. That's a poverty wage. In
Meager.
this country, you can hardly exist on $1,000 a month if that's all you have. That's even less, as I mentioned in our first podcast, than the poverty average retirement benefit of Social Security, which is $1,400 a month, or the average disability benefit from Social Security, which is $1,200 a month. Again, something completely inadequate when, according to the government's own figures, you really need about $3,500 a month to be able to have an apartment, let alone a home in any American city. So it really is a poverty wage. On the other hand, it's also ex exceedingly expensive to do this. I mean, if you were to do this in the United States, with our population of about 330 million or so, and everyone is getting $12,000 a year, we're talking about over $4 trillion. That was the entire federal budget. That would mean that we, in a sense, would be doubling taxation. Now, of course, who's going to pay for that? If we're going to use taxes, of course, to fund it. But you have to also recognize there is then this situation that there's one sector of the population supporting everyone else, the sector that is working. Now, then there's the issue of freedom, and that has to do with the fact that the basic universal basic income essentially leaves you with the kind of hobby existence of a premature retirement. Basically, you just have the resources to meet your needs. You have no other resources to do anything else. And that means what you really can do is very, very limited. I mean, when you're in a work situation, you can do things that depend upon all sorts of capital that are there involved, as well as engaging in an activity that serves, you could say, the common good. Here you're condemned to a purely private existence with no resources to do anything but, in a sense, satisfy your own needs. Now, you mentioned the Speenham Land experiment, which is recounted by Carl Polanyi in his important work, The Great Transformation, which speaks about what happened with the rise of market economies, the rise of capitalism. And this is something that occurred in England at the very beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, the rise of capitalism, when there was a crisis in the rural economy, where the old traditional systems of agriculture were being overturned. And there was a rapid pauperization of people in the countryside. So there was a policy put forward, which was one of giving everyone what could be considered a basic income. It was sort of calculated on what you needed in order to buy the bread that would allow you to survive. And this became something first introduced in a district called Speenhamland. It then was introduced throughout the countryside. And it actually led to a social catastrophe, and it was repealed not long after, in the 1830s. So what is it that happened? Well, on the one hand, it was noted that there was very much a destruction, in a sense, the dignity and fiber of people. You had what could be called the indolence that was the playground of the devil, where people really, they had no independence from which they could derive any kind of satisfaction of in a sense, having their sustenance be something that depends upon their own activity and achievement. So there are all sorts of social ills matter multiplied. There was a stark decline in work discipline and productivity. People didn't feel they had to really take work all that seriously because they had the basic income lying behind them. And then thirdly, I think this is a very important factor to take into account. Employers realized that they could slash wages by the amount of this universal basic income. Because if everyone's getting it, why should they pay for something that their own employees are going to get? So it turned out that employers were being subsidized by the universal basic income. And I think we have to recognize that, you know, all of the problems that I pointed to are problems that a reliance on universal basic income will produce. Now, the idea of a federal job guarantee is very different. And first of all, you have to recognize that a federal job guarantee needs to have tied to it two other things. One is that when we talk about a federal job guarantee, we're talking about the government stepping in as an employer of last resort, where anyone who wants to work is an adult and able to work, but can't find a job, would be offered employment. And worries were raised early on. Hegel, the 19th century German philosopher, who is my favorite philosopher, he pointed out that, you know, if government is going to put people to work doing the kind of things that are already done by the private sector, this is not going to solve the problem of unemployment. It's going to increase the overcapacity, the production of goods for which you have no buyers, that led to unemployment in the first place. Well, there is a route out of this, which is basically that we are going to be putting people to work, providing the kind of things that are not being offered by the private sector, the kind of things, in many cases, that the private sector cannot derive any profit from, namely all sorts of public goods that are made freely available to the public and for which you're not going to earn a profit by producing. Now, you know, universal basic income can address all the kind of things we need. And you can think in terms of our current context, in terms of, you know, what is it we need? Now, part of it is, of course, refurbishing our infrastructure, which is really falling to pieces, according to every American Society of Engineers. We obviously need to make a transition as soon as possible to clean energy if we're going to avert the catastrophes of climate change that are advancing upon us. So we need to make a large public investment and put people to work building the facilities for green energy. We also need public transportation, which is part of that issue. You know, people can't get to work, can't get to friends, can't get to shopping, can't get to medical facilities, not only in cities, but not only in the countryside where it's really pathetically unavailable, but in most cities, it's not as complete as it can be. Of course, we need to furnish decent housing for everyone and refurbish housing that is substandard. Now, all of these kind of construction-related jobs are not going to be sufficient to provide jobs to everyone because they, in many cases, can make use of machinery and the like. They're not always that labor-intensive, and they are susceptible to mechanization and automation. But there are all sorts of robot-proof human services in which we can put people to work, all sorts of caring situations. I mean, think of all the people that need now to be employed in contact tracing. We need people to provide healthcare, to provide educational resources, to provide all sorts of other services, childcare, elder care, and so forth. And of course, cultural provisions. We need to bring all sorts of performances to the public, all sorts of art and culture. Now, as we all know, that these things were all done on a insufficient and somewhat tainted scale during the New Deal. You know, the New Deal was put forward as an emergency measure. It was never enough to absorb all the unemployed, and it was suspended after once World War II came into effect. Also, in a political compromise that was engaged in to gain the support of Dixiecrat senators, the implementation of these New Deal work programs were administered by the states. And that meant in many southern states, the administration of these forms involved, in a sense, a Jim Crow discrimination, where blacks were not put in positions of authority. They didn't receive equal types of work and pay and so forth. Although that wasn't mandated by the program itself, the fact it was left for local implementation led to these abuses. But in any event, you can see that there are many things that can be done today. You can bring broadband to everyone, which is of crucial significance in dealing with the pandemic, either to ensure that you can get the services you need, the benefits you need, that you can work remotely, that you can study remotely, and so forth and so on. These are key matters. Now,
So I guess one of the most typical responses to something like this, and I mean, even though it might irk me to ask it, I guess there's I can try and compound it into one question. If we're accepting a certain level of people who have been rejected from other employment possibilities, then there's the potential for a lot of people would say a delinquent possibility, or maybe a better way to put it would be these people won't be the most sufficiently trained. So in some ways there's the delinquent question, but then there's also how do we actually still compete if we're to employ this, compete with a general private market for the best talent, I suppose, or at least good talent to be able to ensure that broadband is brought to everybody. I mean, the Obamacare website is a famous example of just failing the technological needs for something of that scale. So the Affordable Care Act ran into some issues with possible signups and things like this. It became a certain barrier to entry, actually. But how do you see about that problem? What do you see about?
Well, listen, there's no reason to think that a public employment need be any less efficient than employment in the private sector, right? I mean, there's nothing inherently unproductive about public universities, where I've been laboring for a long time. There's nothing necessarily unproductive about how our various public services, from the military to the space program to anything else, operate. Actually, Medicare is much more efficient than any private health insurer in terms of overhead costs and the like. And when you're speaking about any kind of public works program, the question of labor discipline, is no different than it is in any other work situation. If you don't do the work, you don't get paid, basically,
Exactly.
right?
Yeah,
Now, you
exactly.
will still have the opportunity to have a job, but if you don't do it, you're not going to get paid. Now, when you speak about it, attracting people, I mean, one thing that I didn't mention are two other sides of a federal job guarantee program. One is that, of course, we're not putting people to work at poverty wages. We're going to put people to work at a fair wage. And a fair wage is not a universal basic income. It's not a living wage, because a living wage that only allows you to fulfill your necessities is not enough to exercise your freedoms. It's not enough to have decent housing or to have broadband or to be able to have the time and opportunity to take care of your family and engage in other things besides work. Other things of a public character, like even political involvement. So, what goes together with the federal job guarantee is, in effect, a new fair minimum wage, which is something that needs to be tied to two things. First of all, it has to rise with inflation, so its purchase power doesn't erode. But secondly, if all boats are going to rise, if everyone is going to benefit from the rising wealth of a nation to which their work contributes, we have to adjust our incomes in line with the rising national productivity. Now, I say national productivity because the amount of productivity gains varies tremendously from different kinds of work. If you are a philosopher, there's very little scope for mechanization or automation to increase your productivity. And of course, most of us philosophers, we end up getting employment only in virtue of teaching philosophy. And teaching philosophy, teaching at a university, also is not subject to the kind of mechanization, automation There have been experiments to have these mass, online classes, but they've proven to be inadequate. And I think people are seeing that even online teaching using Zoom, which doesn't involve the same kind of automation, is inferior to in-person teaching. So there are great differences in how much productivity gains can be in different fields, but in a sense, we are all part of the same economy. And if we are going to allow the minimum wage to fairly allow all boats to rise, we then have to, I would say, at the minimum, adjust what was the minimum wage at a time when wages stopped, we're still rising with national productivity, which was in the end of the 60s and early 70s. And in the end, adjust it for how productivity has more than doubled, whereas wages have stagnated. You come up with a minimum wage of about $22 per hour. Now, I'm offering a more modest suggestion of $20 an hour as a start. But
Right.
one thing to keep in mind is we do want to think of this as a new national fair minimum wage. And that indicates that the private sector will have to meet this as well. And, people who can't find jobs are going to either face a situation where they're not going to get support if they're able to work, if they don't take an offer. And I think most people will take an offer. But on the other hand, there are people who cannot work. And of course, we are in a situation of a pandemic where it may be the case that it's hard to come up with enough truly safe workplaces or remote work conditions that allow everyone to be employed. In that case, we have to give them replacement income. We need to give replacement income to those who are retired, to those who are disabled. But we don't want to give them a basic income, which is a poverty income. We want to give them a fair income, the equivalent replacement income. And that means that the proposal of a federal job guarantee carries with it replacement income that is fair for those who cannot work. And that's not giving them a universal basic income. It's giving them much more than a universal basic income. But it's also far less costly because we're not giving everyone a universal basic income. We're providing replacement income only for those who are not able to work. And then when we take up those who are going to be working, well, you have to recognize that to a huge extent, the federal job guarantee will pay for itself. First of all, it'll make largely unnecessary the $1 trillion spent on welfare dependency plans, which will be largely circumvented and made unnecessary if everyone who wants a job can get a job at a fair wage. They also are going to have basically the same kind of productivity of any normal work situation, which means the goods and services produced are going to be at least equal in value to the cost of production, which means we are going to be increasing our national capital at least equal to the public investment made in putting people to work. And it's important to recognize two sides of this. The ending of unemployment and poverty income is fundamentally transformative, both for those who are unemployed and for those who already have jobs. Now, first of all, for those who are unemployed or facing the prospect of entering the job market, we are in a position to really put an end to the school-to-prison pipeline. Because now every young person who comes of working age will know there is a job awaiting them at a fair income that is meaningful, that allows them to produce goods and services that serve the community, and that they can get on-the-job training in these positions. It's transformative for all of those veterans who come back from war and find no job awaiting them and often end up homeless. And of course, that predicament contributes to the fact that 20 veterans a day shoot themselves to death. We would now be in a position to ensure that anyone coming back from war will have a job waiting for them, serving the nation. We also can put the brakes on mass incarceration and recidivism. Because again, everyone will know that they have a job awaiting them where they can earn a legally a decent income. And that will apply to anyone coming out of prison. If you come out of prison today, not only do you suffer the kind of economic lack of opportunity that may have contributed to your being in prison in the first place. But in current conditions, when you come out of jail, out of prison, you know, your job opportunities are worse than ever. So what are you supposed to do? Well, we end that problem with this. But now think of what happens when we consider what the federal job guarantee does. For those who have employment and for business in general, it provides all of the infrastructure and care facilities and so forth that really contribute to the economic welfare of the nation as a whole. It provides maximum consumer demand. You know, it provides us, in a sense, with a way of avoiding those dips in employment levels and consumer spending, because now everyone has money in their pocket. You know, when we talk now about opening businesses, when we're still in a pandemic and there is a huge economic collapse that has taken its toll throughout the world, you know, reopened businesses face a huge problem. You know, people are scared to come to them because it's not sure that they're safe. And secondly, people don't have money in their pockets to buy things. With a federal job guarantee and the replacement income that goes with it, everyone has a steady stream of income. Now, also, it lifts the fear of firing, which means that we can fight for our rights on the job. I mean, one of the main problems facing people in trying to combat sexual harassment on the workplace, or racial and gender discrimination at the workplace, or sexual orientation discrimination at the workplace, is that they have to worry about being fired. And of course, in the United States, if you're fired, well, first of all, in this nation, where unionization is at only 6% in the private sector, maybe 12% in the public sector, I think it's 12%, it's in the teens, most workers can be fired at will. They have no protection against being fired. And without a federal job guarantee, they face two huge challenges. They won't have any income. They face starvation and homelessness. Secondly, they lose health benefits if they have them connected to the workplace. That's a major reason why people are reluctant to, in a sense, fight against harassment on the job and discrimination on the job, or to fight against suppression of unionization on the job. So when we lift the fear of firing with the federal job guarantee, this is liberating for people who are working. And in addition, keep in mind that the tightest labor market will be created. In other words, there is not a huge reserve army of the unemployed standing beside every workplace, allowing employers to resist unionization and keep wages as low as possible. Now, employers will be contending with a reserve army of the employed, and the employed who are going to be making at least $20 an hour. Now, admittedly, you know, if you look at the economic theorists on right and left, whether it's Karl Marx or neoclassical economists, they all agree that markets can never of themselves produce full employment. In some respect, they need to have a source of unemployed workers in order to have a labor force that can be put to work when the economy expands. You know, Marx, for that reason, thought that the reserve army of the unemployed was a necessity of capitalism and capital accumulation. Well, the same thing can be, the same service of a reserve army of the unemployed can be provided by a reserve army of the employed. It's just that employers are going to have to win them back by offering them something better than a minimum wage.
Right.
And that can be done. And, you know, I think when you look at all of these conditions, there's another important thing. You know, and we'll be discussing these matters later. But, you know, we need to enforce the right to health care. And to do that, we need to have some program that does that. And that is going to involve replacing the for-profit health insurance industry. And there are people in that industry who gain their livelihood as part of that industry. Well, if we have a federal job guarantee, we can have Medicare for all and guarantee that anyone who loses employment in the health insurance industry or in those sort of overblown bloated clerical staffs of health providers who need to deal with this proliferation of private for-profit insurance plans, well, those people will have a job at a fair wage awaiting them. The same thing implies to having a Green New Deal. And we will discuss this later in more detail. You know, we need to make a transition to 100% renewable energy by 2030.
Right.
And that means we have to shut down the fossil fuel industries, both in terms of the production of fossil fuel appliances and vehicles, and fossil fuel energy exploration and fossil fuel refining and extraction and so forth. Well, we need to ensure that the people in those fields have a job awaiting them. We can do that with a federal job guarantee. The same thing applies to if we're going to deal fairly with our immigration problem. If we're going to have comprehensive immigration reform and provide a route to citizenship to all of the that vast amount of underpaid employees who are undocumented, if we're going to give them legal status, we have to take seriously the fact that there are people who have a genuine worry that our immigration policies have threatened their job and threatened decent wage levels because there is this underpaid underclass that employers take advantage of, all of these undocumented immigrants. Well, with a federal job guarantee, we can ensure that immigration reform will not put anyone's livelihood in jeopardy.
Right, and I mean,
And we'll discuss later how it's also a key to being able to really provide genuine reproductive freedom. Because genuine reproductive freedom not only means that a woman has access to abortion if she so desires, but just as importantly, that she has access to the economic security and independence to be able to have the children she wants. And a federal job guarantee, as we'll see, plays a key role in doing that. Another side that we need to talk about is the impact of a federal job guarantee on countering the racial gap in income and wealth and unemployment, because it plays a key role. I mean, some of the greatest civil rights leaders, in particular Martin Luther King and Bayard Rustin, advocated a federal job guarantee. And Rustin, in particular, pointed out that there is no way to eliminate racial disadvantage without a federal job guarantee, which wipes out at one blow poverty income, which disproportionately affects African Americans and other people of color, and the higher unemployment rates that disproportionately affect African Americans and other people of color. You know, we see this right now in terms of the effects of the COVID pandemic and the accompanying economic collapse. The most recent unemployment figures have shown that unemployment has risen greatest among African Americans and Latinos and other people of color. And, you know, the reasons are not that mysterious. I mean, first of all, those groups are overrepresented in low-paying jobs in the service sector that were the first and hardest hit by the shutdown. You know, think of all the restaurants and motels and hotels and other establishments that had to close their doors. And of course, these population groups have far less savings to rely upon and be able to make it through months without jobs. They also have much less broadband access and computers to be able to apply for benefits, unemployment benefits or small business benefits. They have much less opportunity to engage in remote work. So in a sense, all these things contribute to a greater unemployment rate, which a federal job guarantee would eliminate by eliminating unemployment in general.
Right, and that elimination of unemployment might very well be the thing that breaks the ball and chain from keeping these people who are so down down in a
And
lot of
one
ways.
thing again, and one thing I want to say that has to do with some of the arguments put in favor of the UBI, because some of those arguments also apply to the federal job guarantee. Namely, The federal job guarantee is not something that it applies to people because of any kind of means tests. It's simply there are jobs. If you want to get a job, you go get it, right? There's no indignity to being involved in it. In this respect, it also does not involve being subject to any kind of paternalistic welfare system. You are standing on your own feet and supporting yourself and your dependents. And thereby you can do it with dignity.
And it doesn't force you to a city. It doesn't force you to a specific subset of your skills. You are able to enjoy different aspects that you think you might be good at. You can go and venture into a certain business. Ostensibly, you can apply for a certain position, and then you can up and move and try and become a well-rounded individual, which is something, I mean, you mentioned Marx, something that is ostent that you think that would happen in the free time, but in fact, it can happen to be able to read by the evening and wake up and work the fields in the morning and have this variety of life. It is possible with getting a job as well, not simply just having the leisure of the income.
And remember, here you are not gaining your sustenance because some other group is producing wealth on your behalf. You are doing it yourself. You are standing on your feet. This, in a sense, is a fulfillment of, let's say, the American dream, where this nation is supposedly committed to allowing anyone who wants to make the effort to be able to support themselves and their dependents. Well, we need a job to be able to do that, ultimately. And that's why, as Martin Luther King said, the civil rights triumphs are not enough. Because if you don't have work and income, if you don't have a job and income, you have neither life nor liberty nor the ability to pursue happiness. And I think we have to recognize that even today, under conditions of a pandemic, we can institute a federal job guarantee where we put everyone who is willing to work safely. And if we really can't find enough safe conditions, we can't provide enough remote work, we can provide replacement income until we move to having as much work operating as can be done. Now, keep in mind that we have millions of people who've been working throughout the pandemic. They've had to work, and they need to be able to work in as safe conditions as possible. And that will apply also to any people who are put to work or, let's say, offered work by a federal job guarantee. We have to ensure that these are safe work arrangements.
And that's the essence of job security. It is the main point. Well, thank you very much for the conversation today. I think it was really good to hear the reflections on the contemporary problems as well, and discussing this. I mean, it's truly a keystone for the rest of these issues that we'll hopefully continue to set up throughout this podcast later on. And this one, I mean, it is one of the most crucial points because of the outlines you made a little bit earlier. So I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation.
Well, thanks, Chris. I look forward to our next engagements,
All
and
right.
I hope our audience will come back to listen.
Sure, till next week.
Yeah, bye.